From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. James Dobson is one of the most powerful evangelical Christian conservatives in America. Now he's accused presidential nominee Barack Obama of dragging the Bible through the gutter. And Republican nominee John McCain offers a $300 million prize to any person who invents a more efficient car battery. Here to give us the political update, Robert Trainum, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast cable network CN8, and Democratic strategist Donna Brazile. She's an author and nationally syndicated columnist. Hey, folks.
Hi, Farai.
Good day with you guys. How you doing?
Oh, I am doing great. I'm doing great. Well, let's focus in on the Dobson-Obama flap. Dobson is a best-selling author and evangelical conservative. He runs a powerful group called Focus on the Family. And he's stirring up some controversy over a speech that Barack Obama gave back in June of 2006. In the speech, Obama mentions Dobson. Let's take a listen.
And even if we did have only Christians in our midst, if we expelled every non-Christian from the United States of America, whose Christianity would we teach in the schools? Would it be James Dobson's or Al Sharpton's?
And in his radio program yesterday, Dobson took aim at Obama's interpretation of the Bible.
I think he's deliberately distorting the traditional understanding of the Bible to fit his own worldview, his own confused theology.
Robert, why don't you flesh this out a little bit more for us in terms of what Dobson is really criticizing Senator Obama for?
Dr. Dobson, as you know, Farai, is literally the leader of millions of evangelical and ideological conservatives around the country. He basically is saying that Senator Obama is a ultra-liberal individual who believes certain things and thus in the process will read the Bible and interpret those things based on his own worldview. Senator Obama has said on more than one occasion that he believes very strongly in an activist government. He feels very strongly that there is a role of government as it relates to helping everyday working individuals, whether they be living from paycheck to paycheck, learning English for the first time, and so forth. Reverend Dobson specifically is saying that Senator Obama is confusing the Old Testament and applying it to the New based on his own worldview. Now, you can make the argument that Mr. Dobson is being a little personal here. However, there are a lot of movement and ideological conservatives out there that are very concerned about Senator Obama's, again, interpretation of the Bible. And it's unfortunate because a lot of it's twisted in their own personal worldview thinking. But also, too, there's a lot of whispering campaigns out there about his name, about whether or not he's a Muslim and so forth. And of course, we know that Senator Obama is a Christian. We know that he is a bona fide American. We know all of these things. But again, there's a lot of misinformation out there. So what Dr. Dobson does is he stirs the pot.
Donna, let's put this in context. Dobson has said earlier that he couldn't vote for Senator McCain because McCain wasn't conservative enough either. So some other conservatives called out Dobson for being destructive to the Republican Party. So what do you think he really wants?
First of all, Dr. Dobson is without a candidate and someone to enthusiastically get behind in this presidential election season. I think these attacks are just politically driven by an individual who would rather attack a candidate who spent Father's Day in a church speaking to a congregation and to a nation about some of the country's most pressing problems, including the lack of fathers in many black households as well as others. Dr. Dobson, it took him 2 years, and one would have to question his timing, to attack Senator Obama's words, which I thought at the time when he was speaking about renewal, he was talking about how some people have used the Bible to hold people back, to oppress people, to tell people that they had no place in society and that their so-called lifestyle was sinful. I applaud Senator Obama for not only speaking out about his faith, but how our faith should guide our lives. And I understand that Dr. Dobson may not be on board with Senator Obama's view of the future and what our government must do to help the least of these, but to attack and denigrate Senator Obama for speaking out on such a important and timely issue as he did back in 2006, perhaps he should read more of Senator Obama's speeches.
Robert, when you look at the evangelical Christian voting bloc, they've had a lot of success in the past few years or the past few elections. certainly President Bush courted them heavily, and there was, the creation of this whole set of faith-based initiatives. Do you think that evangelical Christians are going to have a real significant role in this election?
You know, it really depends on Senator McCain's ability to be able to communicate and to talk their talk. You know, it's interesting because back in 2004, Farai, as you remember, President Bush did a very good job of courting the evangelical vote by talking about issues that were important to them, whether it be same-sex marriage or the banning of same-sex marriage, whether it be prayer in schools, whether it be the ability to be able to wear your personal religious garb in a workforce, whether it be being pro-life and obviously stem cell research. Senator McCain, interesting enough, although he is right on those issues, according to a lot of social conservatives and religious ideologues, doesn't speak about his strong concern about banning gay marriage. He doesn't speak personally about stem cell research and so forth. And it's interesting because a lot of these movement conservatives out there need to hear that. They need to be reassured that he, in fact, is on their side. So what Senator McCain has done is said, you know what, I'm not the right person to be able to talk about these issues, although I am on your side on these issues. I'm going to have surrogates, whether it be Lindsey Graham, whether it be Rick Santorum, former senator from Pennsylvania, a lot of folks that are movement conservatives in my campaign to be able to speak to these issues that are important to you.
Donna, let me move on to something else. Want to talk, since you're such an expert on Democratic politics. Yesterday, a spokesperson for Bill Clinton said that he's committed to helping Barack Obama become the next president, but he, President Clinton, has not officially endorsed Obama yet. So why is that? And what does it really mean to support but not endorse?
Look, I think that former President Clinton will endorse Senator Obama at the right time. First of all, Senator Hillary Clinton is driving the politics now in the Clinton family. And I think her enthusiastic support for Senator Obama, her willingness to campaign this week with Senator Obama in Unity, New Hampshire, her desire to work along with Senator Obama to relieve her debt so that she is freed up to go and campaign in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and other states, I think that speaks volume. Now, we all know that Bill Clinton is a net plus for Democrats. There's every reason to believe that he will be out there on the campaign trail, but I'm sure that Bill Clinton, like many other Americans who've been on a campaign trail, is just trying to get his own house in order, get his foundation back up and running. Look, he put his life on hold for, you know, well over 8 months to help his wife campaign and nonstop. And he will come on board. He will back Senator Obama. But today belongs to Senator Clinton and Senator Obama stepping up to the plate, holding joint fundraisers, and beginning to carry out their responsibility to unify the party and bring about a change in a new direction this fall.
Look, Farai, let's cut to the chase. Endorsements really don't matter a lot. We've seen over and over and over again when celebrities and former presidents and so forth come out and endorse, and it really doesn't move any numbers. However, President Bill Clinton or former President Bill Clinton is still a rock star in Democratic circles. So when he rolls up his sleeves and says, you know what, I'm going to go into the Appalachia, I'm going to go into North Carolina, I'm going to go into those white southern towns where Senator Obama needs to make inroads, that will make a difference. And I think it's very telling that President Bill Clinton, someone who's been very vocal throughout this campaign trail, has decided to speak through a spokesperson as to whether or not or whether when he's going to endorse Senator Obama. I think that's the real question.
Well, you know, Robert, since you want to cut to the chase, let me cut to the chase as well. Senator Clinton is running the show. She is the one right now that is determining what politics she wants out there and who she wants out there speaking. She wants to make this unity moment possible. She's the one who captured 18 million voters, and she was the one on the ballot. So I think it's important to understand that Hillary Clinton is calling the shots right now. I have every degree of respect for Bill Clinton. He will be out there campaigning for Democrats as he's been out there for the last 20-plus years of his life. But right now, it's Hillary Clinton's moment.
You know, Donna, you have a very good point. Senator Clinton did, obviously, was on the ballot. She's the one who ran in all those states. But I find it very interesting, and you're right, she is running the show to a certain degree. But interesting enough, she could not keep her husband quiet when it came to certain controversial remarks over the last 6 or 7 months. That's just a simple fact.
Well, maybe that's the reason why she's keeping him quiet right now, so that she can go out there and campaign for Barack Obama and show the country that the party is unified. Bill Clinton, anyone who knows Bill Clinton knows it. He loves to campaign. He loves to interact with people. And he has perhaps one of the best minds when it comes to politics. The reason why this race was close is because Hillary Clinton had the strategic assets of Bill Clinton at her side to help her navigate the political terrain. And I'm sure at the right moment, at the right time, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama will shock the world when they appear on stage together. Who knows, Robert? It could be any day now. But right now, it's about Hillary Clinton. And I'm glad that Hillary Clinton is taking the stage on her own.
All right, guys, we have very little time. Speed round. Senator McCain said on Monday he's going to give $300 million to anybody who comes up with an improved, more efficient car battery in the age of high gasoline. Good idea. Where's the money coming from, Donna?
It's another one of those meaningless gimmicks designed to get politicians through the next election but offer no real relief to struggling families. I understand that we need new innovation, new alternative fuel sources, but another gimmick, that's not what we need right now.
Very quickly, Farai, Americans are tired of talk. They want action. And when you put money behind something, the American ingenuity spirit will say, you know what, let me try. You know, let's just try and try something different outside of the box. I think that's what Senator McCain was trying to push for.
All right,
this
guys.
This is borrowed money, honey. We need to preserve our treasury, but this is more borrowed money from others, Robert. We need real solutions.
Donna, give me your
not
purse.
Not more happy talk.
Give me your purse, Donna.
I want your wallet. I want your wallet. And when you give me your wallet, I'll call you my boo.
Oh, you guys, I just love it. Donna, Robert, thanks so much. Donna Brazil is a Democratic strategist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist. She spoke with us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. And Robert Trainum is the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast cable network CN8. He was right here with us in Studio B at NPR West. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Jill Scott, Nelly, Ashanti, some of the biggest names in Black Hollywood were in town this week for the BET Awards. We caught up with some of them on the red carpet at an exclusive party, and you will be able to see some of our highly entertaining conversations on our blog. Holding the camera was our web producer, Jeffrey Bennett. How you doing?
I'm good, Farai. How are you?
I'm great. So we were working the red carpet. I haven't done that in years. I used to work for MTV and other places, but I haven't worked a red carpet in years. But we were at the pre-BET Awards dinner hosted by BET Chairman Deborah Lee. So tell us who was there and how folks can catch it on the web.
Well, all the people you mentioned, Deborah Lee herself, Nelly, Ashanti, Jill Scott, Holly Robinson, Pete, Malcolm Jamal Warner. And so people might say, what was News and Notes, a radio show, doing at the BET pre-party with video cameras? Well, it's all part of our effort to incorporate video on our website. It gives us another way to interact with our listeners, and it's experiential. It helps put people at the scene. So here's part of what Nelly had to say to us about your question about his video tip drill.
You know, sometimes we make entertainment for adults. You know, it's not the adults' fault all the time that the kids find the Playboy magazine sometimes. You know, I don't think that Pops intended that to happen, but if they did find it, let's explain it to them and let's not act like it's the worst thing on the world. Let's explain it to them and maybe they can understand it a little more.
So what do you think of that analogy?
Well, you know we're going to talk with MC Light later today, so I'm going to leave that to her. But it was really a good time, and I have to say, having seen you edit this material, it's pretty fantastic what you can do. But let's talk about another person who was not at the BET Awards, mm-hmm. probably very deliberately, R. Kelly. He is still the center of attention following his acquittal on child pornography charges. So what are folks on the blog saying about him?
Well, the latest issue in this continuing saga is a piece that was highlighted by Allison Samuels of Newsweek, who's our entertainment contributor. And the question she asked was, why do Black women continue to support R. Kelly? And so we asked that question, too. Shannon Miles wrote in our blog, "My theory is that Black women are so used to getting the raw end of the deal that they no longer identify with the victim." And Dee Gilchrist wrote, "Here's one Black woman who thinks R. Kelly is guilty, but because of the poor job done by the prosecutor, R. is a free man. Blame them as well."
What else are folks talking about on the blog?
Morgan Tsvangirai of Zimbabwe withdrawing from the runoff election there. And since all things Obama continue to fuel the blogosphere, people are talking about Michelle Obama's image makeover. And there's a clip that we have of historian John Hope Franklin, now 93 years old, talking about how he feels about Obama's success. And if people come to our blog for no other reason than to watch that clip, it'll be well worth it. You know, one cultural legend talking about another potential legend in the making.
So we're actually working on a series about living legends, and we need folks' help. Tell them how they can get involved.
Well, they can either drop us a line on our blog or hit us up on our Facebook page. You know, tell us about some of the people we should interview or profile for this series. It'd be a huge help.
Well, we have some interesting people coming up. I will leave folks in suspense.
Yeah.
Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he joined me from our studios at NPR West. Now on to our bloggers roundtable. The internet is buzzing about a new poll about the racial attitudes of black and white voters. We'll find out what our bloggers think of the results, plus what makes a person legally black, and does America still need affirmative action? With us, freelance journalist Danielle Belton. She runs the blogs Black Snob and the Secret Council of American Negroes. Plus Michael Fauntroy, assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University. He blogs at michaelfauntroy.com, and writer Amani Channel, who blogs at My Urban Report. Hey, folks.
Hello.
Hello, Fran.
So let's start out with this whole race relations poll. A new Washington Post ABC News poll found that nearly half of all Americans say race relations in the country are in bad shape. 3 in 10 acknowledge feelings of racial prejudice, and the other 7 were lying. I'm just kidding on that last part. 53% of white Americans say race relations are good. 60% of black Americans say relations between whites and blacks are not so good or poor. So, Michael, 9 out of 10 whites said they'll be comfortable with a black president, but they admit they harbor some racial bias. So what's going on here?
A whole lot of conflict. You know, for 9 out of 10 to say they'd be fine with it, but yet 3 out of 10 say there's some feelings that they're harboring strikes me as a bit of a conflict. I think this is all a good thing that we have in these discussions. You know, I think that the situation with race relations right now has not been honestly discussed, and this presidential campaign is forcing us at least in fits and starts to have some reasonable dialogue about it. So at least in that regard, I think it's a good thing.
Danielle, the majority of black Americans think that Obama has the potential to really transform racial politics. Whites were less likely to believe that race relations will get better if Obama wins. So why do you think there's that difference of opinion?
I think there's a disconnect because with African Americans, for a long time, it was so unthinkable that a black person would be president. Barack Obama has shown that things have changed enough where you see a black man able to win states, able to win over voters, and seeing white voters support an African-American candidate really was really an eye-opener, I'd say, for a lot of African-Americans. But the reality is, in some of it, I think everyone's so excited and so hopeful that it overwhelms some of the actual, you know, facts on the ground, that it is likely that, you know, race relations still have some work to do, even if Barack Obama's elected president.
Now, Amani, one of our other regular bloggers, roundtablers, Carmen Van Kerkhove, suggests on her blog Racialicious that some folks are afflicted by color blindness, meaning they insist they just don't notice race and claim they just don't care whether people are black, brown, green, or purple. And I'm quoting her here. So do you think, first of all, do you think color blindness even exists, or, you know, is that part of how people are starting to process things?
I think it'd be great if people could see things with color blindness. But I think that when we look at how we're conditioned, when we look at how we relate symbols, and I'm talking about, you know, how we all sort of create symbols to make assumptions about people, I think that everyone has some sort of stereotype or some kind of bias about something, if not about people in general. And these are the generalizations that sort of help us process things. I mean, when you see a red stop sign, you know that means stop. And sometimes, you know, when people think of black, they might think of negative just because of everything we've seen in the media and other things. But the question, I think the bigger question is how do we take those biases in our relationships with others? Am I going to, you know, establish relationships with people outside of my comfortable cultural circle despite something that I may have heard or something that my friend or counterpart may have said about someone else that may have been disparaging? Because that happens in life. So it's really moving beyond what stereotypes or what biases we may have. And, of course, trying to act in a colorblind way, I think, is probably more the realistic way of looking at it.
Faraya?
Yeah.
I want to jump in quickly on that. You know, I think the notion of color blindness, to my way of thinking, is problematic. The reality is, human nature is that we see people in based on our experiences and history and whatnot. And for me, what I'd like to see is more of a focus on respect for differences as opposed to trying to make everybody the same. This sort of Stephen Colbert, I don't see race thing, just sort of drives me crazy, because the reality is some of those people who are saying that, not all, but some of those people who are saying that, aren't being honest with themselves and aren't being honest with the world.
You know, I want to actually ask you guys about, we have a whole bunch of race topics. I mean, we always talk about race, but there's just so many things coming out that are really trying to concretize what's going on today. So there's also a poll by the Pew Research Center that found that more than half of blacks say the country should make, quote, every effort to improve the position of blacks and minorities, even if it means giving preferential treatment. At the same time, half of whites believe the U.S. has gone too far in pushing this kind of situation in the country. So I guess let me start with you, Imani. How do you feel about affirmative action, which some people see as preferential treatment, some people see as, you know, just good politics, some people see as evil? Do you think that at this point affirmative action is necessary?
I think that steps need to be taken to improve diversity within both the corporate environment and also, you know, in educational situations. But I think what we need to be thinking about is affirmative education. How do we level the playing field, get education to these kids who are coming up, get them thinking about how to be entrepreneurs so that when they get to that level, when they're looking for a job, they'll be well qualified? Because I don't think necessarily preferential treatment, if I'm a black candidate going up against a white person and I might not have the qualifications that they have, that I would necessarily feel like I should be hired for that position. However, if I'm equally, if not more qualified, then I think that some, you know, steps should be taken to give me consideration and the opportunity to take a certain job. But, you know, this is a conversation that's going to be had, is going to continue to be had about affirmative action. Obviously, the playing field is not equal. The question is, how do corporations, how does society help even the playing field for African-Americans?
Does anyone, do any of you believe that you benefited from affirmative action?
I would argue that that in my life I have. Specifically when talking about my parents, my father, when he went to college, he studied in engineering. And one of the first jobs he got, and the job that he kept for the rest of his life, was with McDonnell Douglas. And he was able to get employed there. And he's convinced that one of the reasons that caused people to at least accept him or at least see him as a viable person to do his job was because of affirmative action. The only thing that was frustrating for him was when he got there and he saw a lot of times that, you know, he was an architectural engineer. You know, he designed boxes for a while, and he would see other people that basically didn't have a college education, you know, hadn't gone through the 4-year degree, yet they had the same job that he had and got paid more. So that's the kind of a, you know, situation he was dealing with. But my family directly benefited from that affirmative action that helped my dad get that job, because, you know, my father went from, you know, coming from a very poor family, you know, to being, you know, middle class, basically. So, and that directly benefited me.
Michael, Senator Obama has said that he believes affirmative action should be based, at least in part, on the issue of socioeconomics, and that kids like his who are growing up in families of means but who are also black should not be the ones who get affirmative action. Do you think that affirmative action might morph into something that really deals more with socioeconomics than race?
I think affirmative action has always been evolving and will continue to evolve. Part of it is political. The conservative attack on affirmative action has sort of changed the way we look at it, and we found new ways to try to make it work. And in some ways, we can look at diversity in that regard. You know, there may be something to his point, but I would just say that there are, you know, 2.4 million people incarcerated in the United States right now, which is on a per capita basis the world leader. And 46% of them are African American. And so, you know, if you take it out or lessen it for people of means, you still have a vast majority of African Americans who arguably could still be included in some type of affirmative action program or plan. So what Senator Obama is talking about is fine and all, but it just impacts a very small number of people.
All right. Moving on yet again to yet another racial topic. There was a report in EUR, which is a popular website and listserv, and they asked what makes a person legally black. So at one point in time, there was a rule called the one drop rule, which said that if you had even one drop of black blood, you were black. And of course, that helped maintain and sustain the color line. But there's not really a consensus at this point over what is legally black. There's also debate over what role mixed race issues play. You know, Barack Obama calls himself a black man of mixed heritage. Tiger Woods calls himself a Cablin Asian. A lot of people who are mixed race just call themselves black. So, you know, Danielle, what is black in the age of, you know, biraciality?
Well, you know, my theory, and this has always been that you can call yourself whatever you want, but this is America, and basically you are what you look like, and that's not a lot you can do about that. So in the case of Tiger Woods, he is a multi-ethnic person. He does have a lot of different ethnicities in him. When people look at Tiger Woods, they see a black man. And a lot of times, I don't think people got that. That's what Barack Obama was talking about. He has mixed heritage, but it's almost pointless to a certain extent to argue with people, well, you know, I'm biracial, my mother's white. Because people just go, okay, that's nice, black man. You know, that's all they see, black man there. It's no like with question. Halle Berry. You know, they see a black woman. It doesn't matter that her mother's white. And it goes on and on and on. There's so many biracial people who have a black parent who just choose to go ahead and align themselves with being black because in America, you are what you look like. And if you look brown, and if you have black features, you're black.
Well, you know, actually, I was talking to a famous black biracial person who always calls himself black, not Barack Obama. And he said, you know, Tiger Woods, if people were going down the street and spearing black people in the back with a pitchfork and throwing them in a truck, I would take Tiger Woods and I would pull him in the alley because, you know, he needs to get off the street. Yeah. I mean, Amani, you know, at this point in time, is there any point, though? I mean, another question is that after several layers of intermixing, if someone, for example, has a black great-grandparent, is that person black, even if they don't look black at all?
Well, that's a good question to have. I mean, there are so many levels to this discussion. I mean, this is even a question that I have to answer to this day. For whatever reason, I have some Native American or even some think Eastern Indian facial features. So I get asked the question all the time, are you black? Well, I'm, you know, chocolate complexion, and I was raised in East Palo Alto, California, which is an urban area in the Bay Area. And so I was raised culturally black. You know, it's how we define ourselves. It's the way you walk. It's what kind of music you listen to. It's a cultural, it can be a cultural experience. So just to look, base it upon what's in your blood or what's how you look or the way you talk. I mean, it's really not fair. I mean, you know, there's even a degree of if you don't speak a certain, you know, slang talk that maybe people consider black people may consider you white because you don't act a certain way. So there's so many different levels to this. But yes, I'm sure there are a lot of white people who have drops of black blood in them who look very white, but they'd be surprised to find out about their lineage. So are they black? I mean, are you looking at it at a DNA level, which is very specific, or are you looking at it as your cultural experience, who you identify with, who's within your, you know, social circles? And it's a conversation that obviously is going to continue, especially in the wake of this 2008 election cycle. And it's a conversation that needs to be had because there are black folks who have issues against, you know, dark-skinned folks who might have issues against light-skinned folks. Being, right. You know, I have associates and friends of mine who are light-skinned, and they battle issues of trying to, yes, I'm black, you know. So I don't know. I mean, we just need to have more conversations like this, though,
Well, you know what, guys? I have to break it off. We don't have any more time. Clearly
oh, no,
a hot topic.
Sorry.
No, perfect. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking with writer Amani Channel, who blogs at My Urban Report. He was at Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Danielle Belton runs the blogs Black Snob and the Secret Council of American Negroes. She was at KWMU in St. Louis, Missouri. And Michael Fauntroy, assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University. He blogs at michaelfauntroy.com and was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. You can also go and speak your mind online to find out how. Go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. MC Lyte is seen as a pioneering woman in the world of hip-hop. Now she's moderating a new BET television town hall series called Hip Hop Versus America 2, Where Did the Love Go? It specifically digs into gender relations in hip-hop and in the hip-hop generation. Think super sex-soaked hip-hop videos, lyrics about hoes and tricks, and I'm not just talking about ones from male rappers, but female ones as well. R. Kelly and his recent acquittal on child pornography charges. There is plenty for men and women to talk about. BET premieres Hip Hop Versus America 2 tonight, and we've got MC Lyte with us to break it all down. It's great to have you back on.
Thank you.
So I saw you out and about at all the BET events. It was great stuff. Uh-huh. And, you know, last year you and I were both panelists on the BET Hip Hop Versus America. Now you're coming back as a moderator, holding down the fort. First of all, just give me an example of something that a conversation that unfolded during, you know, the process of making this.
The process of making it, or taping?
Yeah, the taping.
Oh, boy. Well, there was a moment that Little X and I had, and it was a panel where we were discussing videos. And most of the panelists were actually women who are in videos, and one of the women was Delicious from Flavor Flav's show. And I posed a question to the women, and Little X chimed in and said, you know, most of these women, and I had to say, I'm not really talking to you. Like, I'm talking to these women.
Right.
You know, and right. I think for too long, men have spoken for women or think that we can't speak for ourselves. I'm like, and so we had a little moment there, and he retreated because I think he did find himself out of himself and totally, like, enraged, only because he could possibly be mad at himself. I'm not quite sure, but I had to cease and seckle. And he's actually a really good friend of mine as well. And we talked after, but during the process of it, it got heated. It got heavy. David Banner took it there. The gentleman who does the show running for Chris Rock's show.
Mm-hmm. Everybody hates Chris.
Yeah, Everybody Hates Chris. That got a little heated, you know, not just with me, but amongst themselves.
Yeah, I mean, you know, last time it was also heated and it was wide ranging. Why did you guys decide to focus in on gender issues this time?
Well, I think they're going to do this many times over, and this is just one particular sector they decided to go into, because there's issues all over the place within hip hop, but I think this is one that they wanted to dive into.
Let's dig into your career. I mean, you have been rhyming professionally for well over a decade, you know, and you are someone who true hip hop fans adore. What was your path into the industry? How did you get into it? And how do you feel being a woman has affected your ability to do what you do?
Oh, boy. Well, I can say this. I think going through it was just me going through it. I didn't really have any, like, preconceived notion as to what it was going to be like. I did want to go in the footsteps of Salt and Pepper, but that was just by way of hearing them and wanting to emulate them in some sort of fashion. But I didn't have any idea of what I was facing. I was just doing it. And I think second time around, you know, I'm able to see things much clearer and, you know, it's sort of move in slow motion now. And I think back then I wasn't really in present time. I just was there going through the motions, and it sort of panned out nicely because of the people that I was surrounded with. And it made it a little bit easier. And I think being a woman in the game made it that much easier because there's so many males.
Really?
Yeah. So it's a male dominated field. And I think to be able to stand out, you've got to either look a different way or present some other type of fashion, which we've seen done many times over, or you have to be saying something that's different from what's being said. And I think at the time when I first came out, they thought I was a little boy. They, you know, every time they would meet me for the first time, oh, my God, you're MC Lyte. Like, I thought you were like a 12-year-old boy or something like that. And I was like, no, not so. So I think it actually worked for me at that time.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. Well, let's talk, you know, you mentioned fashion as it you know, relates to female MCs. And so you've got rappers like Jean Grey, who's respected as an MC, but she doesn't go out of her way to flash a lot of flesh. Rappers like Lil' Kim and the recently incarcerated Remy Ma are female MCs, and they're always working the skin-tight clothes, you know, the hot pants, the weaves, all that. So how do you think women who are very overtly sexual are treated differently than women who are not in terms of their fan base or how people relate to them?
Right. Well, let me just say this. I think those particular women who wear the skin tight and they do that regardless, whether they were rapping or not. That's who they, no, really, that's who they are. And I think, like, when I came out and I had the baggy jeans and the T-shirt, like, I didn't make that up. We all wore that in Brooklyn. That was the uniform, you know, the huge gold earrings. I represented every girl from Brooklyn at that point. But I think how we're treated, to me, I always wanted to be heard, not just looked at. And I think because the field was so male dominated and I'm on that stage rocking for an audience of guys, rather than to have them gawking over me, I wanted them to hear my words. So there was a point in time where I tried to, you know, get a little sexy with it. And the exec at the record label was like, what is this? You know, they had just paid like 10 grand for this photo shoot and was like, scratch it. We need to do another one. Put your jeans on and, you know, hit Brooklyn. So at that point, I realized that I didn't have to push to be anything else but myself. And whenever I felt like I wanted to do that, I would.
All right. Just quickly, you have a new group, Almost September.
Yes.
I've heard the stuff on MySpace. You haven't dropped an album yet. It sounds great.
We dropped the 6-song EP.
Oh.
It's available digitally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell us just quickly, what's your sound?
The sound is soul hip-hop.
Soul hip-hop. You've got a bunch of bandmates. You yourself are rhyming. How does it feel?
And to other people, it feels great. I love a collaboration. It always feels good when people are in the room for the best of the song, you know, like everybody wants the best of a song.
All right. Well, you guys got to come into the studio and grace us with your music.
We will. And almostseptember.com so people could get a taste.
All right. Yeah. MC Lyte, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
MC Lyte is a hip hop pioneer and co-host for BET's new town hall series, Hip Hop Versus America 2, Where Did the Love Go? The series begins tonight. And she joined us from our NPR studios here in Culver City.
About me, because rules were meant to be broken. That's why the world can't forget about me, because rules were meant to be broken.
The lyrics on his new album say don't change, but rapper Lyrics Born has kept his game on the move. He's done mixtape-style compilations and released his own albums and singles. Now the Bay Area stalwart's got a new album called Everywhere at Once, and it brings elements of funk and R&B into the mix. Lyrics Born, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much.
So I understand you really launched into music when you were at the University of California, Davis. So when was that, and who were you, and what was it like?
Well, you know, I'd been rapping for years, I mean, since grade school and so forth. But, I really didn't make my professional outing until college. And at that time, we were just, you know, just all hanging around the college radio station and listening to music and writing songs, and none of us had really released any albums yet. And it just dawned on us that, you know, given the state of the industry, if we weren't going to put out our own records, then our music probably would never get heard. And fast forward 10 plus years later, this is it.
So what was it like performing for the first time in a venue, not in a dorm room, not just with your friends? Where were you and what was that like?
I think the first, what I would consider the first show was, I was the very first act on a show at a club here in San Francisco called The Stone. And on that bill, it was pretty amazing. I was absolutely first. And on a
which
on
is a blessing and like, a curse.
Yeah, I mean, on a bill of like 15 people. So I think at that time it was, oh man, it was Nas, Cool G Rap, The Far Side, Freestyle Fellowship, Souls of Mischief, Apache.
Wow.
Master A. I mean, this gives you, I mean, I was
That's
like,
amazing.
I think I was like 18, you know what I mean? So it kind of gives you an idea of the time period. And I just remember I was a little nervous. Every time that I get up on the microphone, I gotta dedicate a round to your girl, come on. You know, being an independent artist my whole career, I always knew that the music that I was making had more scope and more potential than what the numbers suggested. It was just, it's always a question of opportunity. I don't care where you're from, the first time that I saw you, girl, you had me sprung just the way that my name rolls off your tongue. Damn near knocked all the wind out my lungs. Baby girl, you the one, you the maximum. You got every man begging for scraps and crumbs. I can't run, I want it all in one lump sum. But girl, you got me sitting on my hands and thumb. I ain't done. Girl, you got the magic touch. You seen every man out there and passed him up except one. Baby girl, that's what's up. I can't wait for the day when we hang and tough. I said, I'm not sure what you did to me, but I like.
So you've worked with DJs and with a live band. You have a live band. So how did you put this album, Everywhere at Once, together? What was your process? I mean, did you write first and then go in the studio, and how did you collaborate?
Well, I think as your career grows and, you know, the more albums you make, it becomes more and more challenging to venture into uncharted territory. You know, it's like, how can I, you know, I'm always asking myself the question, what am I going to do tomorrow? And I think going into this album, you know, I asked myself that same question, and it was, okay, the answer was, I'm going to make this album more personal. In other words, I'm going to talk about, ask, you know, maybe some challenges and some victories that I've had in my life that maybe people didn't know about before. And then I'm also going to approach the production process differently. I'm not going to use samples, which I had done for years. I'm going to get in there with a band. You know, we're going to replay everything, or we're going to create on the spot. Really took a different approach to production on this album. And like I said, I mean, you know, it's important for me to stay continually challenged, because, I mean, I don't really feel like I can be inspiring if I'm not inspired. And the only way that I can stay inspired is if I'm always being challenged.
You were born Tom Shimura in Tokyo, raised, you know, a bunch of different places, and you used to go by the name Asia Born on stage.
Yes.
So when and why did you change your stage name?
I changed it in 1994, and really it was because what was happening was I started getting a lot of press as being, quote-unquote, the Asian rapper, the Japanese rapper, the Asian one, the Japanese guy. You know, and I think, like most, I think, you know, people of color in this country, or just anybody in this country, we all want to be evaluated based on our merits, you know, and our skill. Especially when you're an artist, you want to be evaluated based on your art. And I thought that, you know, being singled out in that way, I didn't think was fair to us as a group, and I didn't think it was fair to myself. And so, you know, I wanted to make albums where I would be evaluated as the artist. You know, nobody wants to be called the Asian actor, or the, you know, the Asian plumber, you know what I mean, or the Asian DJ. You know, you're a man, you're an artist.
You have one song, Is It the Skin I'm In, that talks a little bit about stereotyped preconceptions. Tell me a little bit about that one.
Well, I think, you know, going back to what we were talking about before, it's like, now here I am 10 years later in my career, I can talk about my challenges on my terms and constructively, you know, instead of, you know, the thing that a lot of people don't realize is that, you know, at least for myself, throughout the course of my career, I've been called a million different things that I never came up with, you know. And it goes back to what I was saying before, is, you know, I really got a lot more personal on this album in a lot of different ways than I had in the past on previous records. I get asked in interviews a lot, you know, like, what has it been like, you know, being Asian American, being an Asian American rapper, being an Asian American MC, being in the entertainment business, you know, as an Asian American, you know. I get asked about it so many times, so much that, and it is such a part of my life that, obviously, that that's why I wrote the song, Is the Skinny.
Now I'm grown, I say now I'm on it. I still feel it every day of the week. But I don't trip about it now, cause I see it really ain't got a thing to do with me. It only hurts if you let it.
I mean, how would you describe, you have a variety of sounds, a variety of approaches to DJing and producing music, but it's not, you know, it's not the guy who's just in the cipher on the corner, and it's not 50 Cent. So at least in terms of how you interact with your peers and the people who are, you are tight with, how would you describe who you are and then where you see the artistry going from here?
The interesting thing about hip-hop right now is, you know, you could ask 10 different people what hip-hop is, and they'll give you 10 different answers, and they're all correct. That's the point in history that we're at right now. I mean, you know, hip-hop spans from, you know, Atmosphere to Lyrics Born to Lil Jon to 50 Cent to, you know, to Eminem to, you know, Def Jux to, you know, it's just a million different things to a million different people right now, and I think it's just going to continue on all these various trajectories, and it's going to continue to morph and blend and change. And, you know, that's just what it is. I mean, it's almost like, you know, if you look at rock now, I mean, there's a million different kinds of rock, you know, and I think that that's, you know, that's the direction that hip hop is going in.
Well, Lyrics Born, thanks so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Rapper and producer Lyrics Born's new album is Everywhere at Once. He joined us from the studios at UC Berkeley School of Journalism. I came a long way from eating off brand rice.